So I'd just like to introduce our final speaker for today, Tara McDowell. Tara McDowell is an Associate Professor and Director of Curatorial Practice at Monash University. She has held curatorial appointments at the CCA Wattis Institute for Contemporary Art, San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art. And she's completed a PhD in the history of art, at the University of California, Berkeley. Her recent curatorial and research interests include speculative histories, experimental pedagogy, alternative archives and documentation, contemporary curating, and public space. McDowell was the founding senior editor of the Exhibitionist Journal. Her most recent book, The Artist As, was published by Sternberg Press in 2018, and The Householders Robert Duncan and Jess is forthcoming from MIT Press in 2019. And I'd just like to welcome Tara and her paper, If All the World Were Paper and All the Water Ink. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you to Eleanor and Celia for organizing, and fellow speakers and all of you for being here. It's really an honor. I'm going to do something that I think no one else has done, which I was going to read from my own work. We'll see how that goes. I have this kind of, I'm the academic on the panel, but somewhat uncomfortable, maybe on our best day, unruly one would hope. My training is really in museums, so I am used to writing for, a larger audience, a museum audience. Obviously, that's still not a generalist audience, but that was sort of my training, and then I went off to do a PhD, and then have just ended up in the academy. But I came to Australia about 5 years ago to do to launch the first curatorial practice PhD in Australia, and it's also one of the first in the world. But I'm really trained as an art historian, so I find myself in a constant state of gentle displacement that I think is generally productive. I do lots of different kinds of writing, but I wanted to speak to you today about three, maybe it'll just be two, recent texts that I wrote and ways that I was trying to push beyond my comfort zone and things that I was trying to do to challenge the curatorial voice, also the art historical voice. And then at the very end, if there's time, I'm going to make sure that there's time, because I know that some of you are emerging art writers. I have this talk that I give to my PhD students that's advice for how to write a good exegesis, and I've taken out the ones I think are not appropriate for this, that are maybe too boring, but I've tried to keep some of the writerly advice that I would pass on. I'm just curious, how are any of you currently writing within an academic context? Could you raise your hand? Okay. So more, maybe about a quarter to a third of you. Let's see. Whoops. So what I'm going to do is read just a couple of excerpts from this exhibition catalog. This was a project that I did in a place that you probably didn't think you would go to today, which is the Republic of Georgia in the former Soviet Union. And I was invited to curate an exhibition at an artificial Soviet city there, just outside the capital of Tbilisi, called Rustavi, for the second Tbilisi Triennial. So some of my more experimental writing has been coming out of my curatorial practice and is sort of linked to that. So those of you who are practicing curators may be interested in this. The exhibition was called 124908. These are some of the artists. There were a number of Australian artists. And this is where it starts to get kind of funky. What I aimed to do was to preserve the temporality of curatorial writing. So when you write curatorially, you often write before the show, and you rarely write after the show. It was when I was when I was senior editor of the Exhibitionist that we began to commission curators to reflect on their past exhibitions. And it wasn't really a mode of writerly practice that exists, but it that had existed until that point, but I found it to be an extremely fascinating and very vulnerable kind of writerly voice to bring about. And often when you write curatorially, when you write an essay for, let's say, an exhibition catalog, or even within the context of academia for a scholarly essay for an article, you write the thing in pieces, right? But then you condense it all as if it has sort of a unified voice. So what I aimed to do instead was to preserve the fact that I was writing on different days and writing before, during, and after the exhibition. So that's why the entries are each dated like this. This show was also an homage and sort of an appropriation of Lucy Lepard and her number of shows from the 1960s. So that's why a couple of the entries are from 1960, because they're usually Lepard texts. This is the way it begins. And as you can see, the very top is September 14th, 2015. So the exhibition hadn't opened. It wasn't going to open for 2 weeks, but I was writing this text for the opening lecture of the exhibition. I'll just read the first couple of paragraphs. The city of Rustavi, population 124908, 124,908, is a quick 30-minute drive from Tbilisi, Georgia's capital. The mashrutkas, or private minibuses, run with such frequency between the two cities that they depart from the Tbilisi Sport Palace every 2 minutes. A mashrutka's destination usually appears on a sign placed inside the windshield. Gori, the birthplace of Joseph Stalin, Akhmeta, at the edge of Pankisi, the Muslim region bordering Chechnya, Batumi, the flashy Black Sea resort town, Zugdidi, the gateway to the epic peaks of Svaneri and the breakaway region of Abkhazia, closed to Georgians following a brutal civil war and scattered with Russian tourists on a cheap holiday. But the mashrutkas don't name Rustavi. The sign simply reads straight. As the closest city to the capital, it's the default destination. And Rustavi is reached via a straight line. Mashrutkas and taxis speed down a new highway connecting the two cities, overtaking slower vehicles with terrifying nonchalance. But the refusal to name the city also signals its neglect. Georgians, some of whom grew up there, describe Rustavi as a dead city, a city where nothing happens. This is because the city was purpose-built around the Rustavi metallurgy plant, which shut down when Georgia seceded from the Soviet Union in 1991. Gala Aristavi, one of the artists who founded Block 21, Rustavi's first contemporary art space, shared with me a daunting list of issues the city faces, beginning with high unemployment, currently a staggering 65%. He cites poor infrastructure and housing conditions, ineffectual local government, lack of green and social spaces, and unused public spaces. Then there are the immaterial problems, such as residents' widespread apathy or even hostility toward the city, and Rustavi's current status as a satellite city, one in which the gaze is always drawn elsewhere. So it went on a bit like this. I also included very selective emails that the artist had sent to me. This is Ash Kilmartin, who's a New Zealand artist based in Rotterdam. And she writes, "It's interesting to think of the titles of the number show, Lepard's and yours too, to think of that number not as a quantity, but as a moment, a marker of time in a particular place, rather than of human density in that place, a statement, however abstract, of the specific condition of that date." So I was thinking a lot about, in the curatorial practice, there's a lot of writing emails that never appear in any kind of format. And again, thinking about that kind of vulnerability of voice and kind of exposing my own writerly practice and scaffolding to perhaps include an email or two, I got the permission of the artist. So this is October 1st. This was 2 days before the exhibition opened. Again, I'll just read maybe a paragraph or two. "Between 1969 and 1974, Lucy R. Lepard, the American writer, activist, feminist, and curator, organized a series of numbers shows titled for the population of the city in which they were staged." So it goes on a little bit. "The exhibitions gathered a broad swath of art we now describe as conceptual and post-minimalist, and were sprawling, scrappy, and nimble, with many works either made on site via the artist's instructions or carried by Lepard in her suitcase. 124908, the title of this exhibition, directly cites Lepard's numbers, shows, and its methodology appropriates hers too." So it goes into that a bit and why I decided to do that. This is the photography. So I had a photojournalist document the exhibition, and her images meant that it was completely unlike traditional installation shots. This is the city with the factory. And then now here I am, October 29th, writing after the show has opened. So I'm writing in a reflective state about it. 124908 comprised 8 temporary installations scattered throughout the center of Old Rustavi, all within walking distance. On October 3rd, 2015, a group made up of Georgians, mostly involved with contemporary art in Tbilisi, international visitors to the triennial, mostly participants, and a handful of locals from Rustavi began a tour through the city that took us from the Rustavi Metallurgy Plant to the Chemist Culture House, to the Rustavi City Museum, and into the city park to visit a zoo abandoned after Georgia left the Soviet Union, and a newish outdoor amphitheater. So then it goes on, and then what happens next is it walks you through the show, and I write the day as sort of as it was happening. And what was so great was because all the digital images were time stamped, we were able to put the exact time of when the event was happening. And so it goes on a bit like that as I describe each of the works. So if that one was 3 o'clock in the afternoon, now it's 5:14. This is walking into the park. We walked a short distance from the museum to the city park, where Leonie Contini appropriated the grounds of an abandoned zoo, included 3 rusted and overgrown animal cages, long disused. Exploring the area and climbing a fence, Leonie discovered a shed inside a stonemason's yard filled with plaster casts of heads, some recognizable historical figures in Georgia, bodies of a young boy and girl broken into pieces, and animals including a monkey and a dog. Some were whisked away and discreetly installed throughout the zoo's environs, nearly hidden from view. Amidst this gently surrealist landscape, Leonie gave a lecture performance from inside the circular cage, a history of episodes, usually times of social and political breakdown, in which people broke the taboo and ate zoo animals, including describing extraordinary recipes involving zoo animals devised during the Paris Commune. Rumor has it that in the 1990s in Rustavi, zoo animals were eaten too. That's because it was just a period of total social breakdown. And then, let's see. You can see there's some more of the images. And then I'll just end this one here. So this was just a note that I jotted down in the 2 weeks before the exhibition. And I included this too. So you can see this is September 11, 2015. What would it mean to adopt another curator's methodology only to realize its flaws and limitations, and the flaws and limitations of your attempt to transpose it once it's too late to turn back? What does it mean to make modifications and concessions throughout the process? Or does the value lie in the failure of appropriation, which allows some insight, some other awareness of both then and now to come into focus? So that was me sort of in the midst of it, having this moment of wondering what it meant to transpose something from 1970 to now. And I guess this whole project was about that idea of temporality and that idea of time and what it might mean to mark it differently than we usually do in our curatorial writing. Okay, I'll leave that one there. So this is definitely one of the weirdest things I've ever written. So this was an exhibition catalog essay for an exhibition at MUMA, the Monash University Museum of Art, so the museum, university museum where I work. And Charlotte Day, who's the director there, was curating the show about the future called Future Eaters. Did anyone see it by any chance? So she asked me to write about the future of the museum. And it was right after I had had my daughter. It was the first thing that I wrote after coming pseudo back from maternity leave. And actually, this condition of being a new mother is something that I have gently insisted on. I mean, maybe it's a kind of, I guess it's emerging from a feminist position of acknowledging the conditions under which I work and acknowledging that this is sort of the new reality of my writerly life, of my academic life. So has anyone ever read the Choose Your Own Adventure books when you were a kid? So I decided to write this essay as a Choose Your Own Adventure story. So I think there's ways in which things from my childhood, and even the title of this talk, so if all the world were paper and all the water ink, if all the trees were bread and cheese, what would we have to drink? It's a nursery rhyme that I read sometimes in a book of nursery rhymes to my daughter. It's also the title of a painting by the artist Jess, who you probably don't know, but I wrote a book about him that'll be out next year. So maybe we'll get to that, probably not. So I thought maybe we could do this if we have time. You're in a park, sitting under a tree, reading Octavia Butler's sci-fi classic, Parable of the Sower, when storm clouds appear overhead. Glancing around, you see a building in the distance where you could take refuge. It seems open, and you could reach it in a few minutes if you moved quickly. In the other direction is a narrow street that has no immediate shelter but is closer and tree-lined. As the rain begins to fall in big, heavy drops, you need to make a choice. If you choose the building, turn to page 32. If you opt for the street, page 27. So how many want the building? Raise your hands. And the street? Oh, there's more for the street. Okay. Let's see. So, if you opt for the street, 27. I think I need to make this a little bit smaller. Walking down the street, you notice an old three-story Victorian, the front of which is wide open. It hardly looks like public space, but is the first open door you see. If you go inside, turn to page 28. If you keep going, turn to page 32. So who wants to go inside? And who wants to keep going? Ah, I think it's go inside. Okay, let's see. Sorry, the page numbers are so small. Curious and wet, you climb the stairs and walk inside. The house is decidedly old-fashioned with peeling wallpaper, dark wooden molding, and built-in bookshelves filled with leather-bound reference volumes. A stack of brochures sits on a small table. You pick one up and read, "We will all gain a deep understanding of humanity when modern curators turn their gaze away from the rich, high culture of the past, like those first novelists who tired of writing sagas about the lives of kings, and observe instead the lives we lead in the homes we live in, especially outside the Western world. The future of museums is inside our own homes." Time can be circular as it is linear, such that we find ourselves where we've been before, like the court artists employed by the Byzantine, Chinese, Japanese, and Mughal empires, and in European royal courts from Portugal to Germany, artists have again entered a system of patronage. Government divestiture from the arts began slowly, but other austerity measures inflicted upon citizens soon became impossible to stop, let alone roll back. The oligarch patrons emerged as a neo-aristocracy after consolidating grotesque amounts of wealth and power and building vanity museums mimicking ancient temples and medieval castles to house and display their collections. So it required no real leap of imagination to propose acquiring an artist rather than an artwork, especially given the desperate and precarious situation artists found themselves in once their other support structures collapsed. In the parlor, a calico cat walks across a half-completed puzzle on a coffee table. A man seated on a couch invites you to join him. He lives here with his husband, you learn, and the calico. You're welcome to stay a while. The house doesn't close until 4. Artist houses, he tells you, over cups of oolong tea, had been acquired and opened as small intimate museums for a long time, and there were examples of artists opening their own homes as public displays. The Vietnamese-born Danish artist Jan Vo did this in Berlin once. But the current model, which is something of a hybrid of the two, is more recent. The collector, or as often as not, corporation, pays all the artist's bills, rent, utility, groceries, insurance, childcare, medical, you name it, until he dies. In turn, the artist need only open his or her house to the public for a certain number of hours each week. Each artist involved in such an arrangement chooses when to open their doors. A night owl he knew liked 1 to 4 a.m. and swore she got the most interesting guests this way. People can experience how artists live, he explained, have conversations or not, poke around, see what other art and objects and images the artist likes and collects. It's very intimate, not to mention idiosyncratic, as are all of our homes. He tells you of an artist who transformed her house into a small textile operation for a half dozen women weavers, all supported by her patron, all living in the house. Another devoted his apartment to a lost love. Another used the arrangement to collect rare recordings of nearly forgotten languages, of which he had collected nearly 40,000, and which played night and day in the different rooms of his house, a cacophony of voices, even though he lived alone. With the resources of their patron, an artist couple moved their family home onto a pontoon in the ocean before the seas claimed the island. A helicopter brings supplies daily and flies their children to school and back. And then I just write, at the end of each museum, I just, instead of citation, I just write what the sources that inspired the text. The Museum of Artists Houses is inspired by Stefan Benquim, Elmgren and Dragset, Robert Duncan and Jess, Susan Hiller, Lucy McKenzie, Solveig Estebo, Orhan Pamuk, Dianita Singh, and Jan Vo. So, is that 2 minutes? Okay, let me just... I will do this last part super fast. Advice for the day. This is take it or leave it. Texts are not your only interlocutors. A lot of artists and art historians who do PhDs with me resort to theory, I feel like, way too frequently, whereas there's so many other extraordinary things, including other artists and other artworks in the world. Nietzsche's definition of theory, which I've always loved, is the ability to think one thing with another, not necessarily an artwork with a text. This is Agnes Martin in her new Mexico studio looking at a painting. Ask questions, in fact, make lists of questions. These were just some of the questions that I wrote when I was writing about my two artists, one a poet and one an artist, and thinking about collaboration, and ended with this question about, is collaboration a good thing? Why do we assume that collaboration is even a good thing? Articulate your deepest worries and think them through as a method problem. Usually whatever you're most scared of in your writing is actually the most interesting thing about it. Beware intellectual political correctness, falling into line with received ideas without putting sufficient pressure on them. That's something I see a lot. Finding a disturbance can be a productive method. I think of Frantz Fanon as being sort of the epitome of this. What can't people on the ground see? What is invisible? What histories, what narratives are not being discussed? What's not been said? Everyone focuses already so much on what's been said. Trouble with tone. Structure, beginning, endings, intellectual differences, unpacking quotes, rhetorical strategies. Locate academic writers whose style, methodology, and argument you admire. Study their writing closely. This is a picture of Anne Wagner, who's my PhD advisor. And every time I go to write something, I try to read something by her first, just to get her in my head. Beware of, she's kind of like another maternal figure. Beware of frozen or stuck thinking, revise, revise, revise. Understand that your questions and concerns will evolve over time. Your last chapter will be your best. This is Walter Benjamin. Write as if for publication, be generous to your reader, do not obfuscate, do not hide behind language, define terms, balance description with exegesis. This is my last slide, I promise. Provide evidence to support claims, imagine an ideal reader. That's one that's quite good, I think. Dispel doubt, no need to go elsewhere, right? You need to build the foundation for the thing so you don't have people going, well, what about that, what about that? Make stakes felt, understood, vital. Read your work out loud, have the work tested. Remember that language is a conspiracy against experience and that the visual is always resistant to the verbal. Thanks.